All right, the committee will come to order. First, Representative Murphy, will you move the minutes from the February 11th meeting?
So moved. Yeah.
Any questions on those? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Oh, and there's another one, February 12th, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I move those minutes from February 12th.
All right. And the questions, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Those minutes are adopted. The no noted. Okay. And this is what we're going to do today, members. We have House File 161, which I'm going to move here shortly, which... We'll go through, and if we can get to a vote, that would be good. And then we're going to just talk about. We're going to have people present their different non-emergency medical transportation bills, and get some background information on it. And then we'll have further discussion later. But just to kind of, the goal is to try to identify the issues as far as possible, and narrow in on what's really in controversy. So. Madam Chair, I would move House File 161 that it be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Public Safety.
Okay.
Public Safety Policy.
All right. Representative Thiessen moves House File 161 that it be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Thiessen, you have an amendment. Do you want to start with that, or do you want to...
Yes, Madam Chair. This is the A90040 amendment, and really what it does, it doesn't particularly change the substance of the bill that much. It changes dollar amounts, and the other big change is that it, instead of having the EMSRB board in charge of this pilot program, it has the Department of Public Safety in charge. So I'd like to put that on if I could.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves Amendment A090040. Are there any questions about the amendment before we vote on it? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to turn it over to the testifiers if I could.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. The bill that you have before you seeks to address a couple of unmet needs for the EMS provider community. And I'll try to make it as brief as possible going into the background. We're requesting funding for a number of programs that are listed in the bill that Mr. McAlpin, who is president of the Ambulance Association, and I will talk about. It is funding for existing programs. It is one-time funding, and it comes out of an existing source, so it's not new spending out of the general fund. In the early 1990s, the ambulance industry worked to create a program that would help recruit and retain volunteer ambulance personnel in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota. Working with a number of legislators, we're able to identify a kind of an obscure fund called PEEP, which I'm not an expert in this area, so if I misspeak, please correct me. But as I understand it, it was an overage in the amount of money that was paid by the state to local units of government for their share of police pensions. And there was every year a surplus in this fund. So we went after a portion of that to create this volunteer ambulance recruitment retention plan, which was named the Cooper Sams plan several years ago. The money was in statute $1 million a year that went into this fund. Then over a period of time with budget cuts and all, the EMS Regulatory Board proposed to decrease the amount of money to meet the percentage cuts that they had to make as part of the balancing budget program. We got down to $700,000 a year. What happened is a number of years ago there was a general trend to eliminate these pockets of dedicated funds, specified funds, put more into the general fund so that the legislature could make the determination on priorities, not the statutes with the program here, a program there. Money was put into the general fund. If you're a volunteer on an ambulance, you get one credit year with the dollar amount based on the number of eligible volunteers and the balance in the fund. The fund kind of snuck up on us, frankly. Found out there's roughly $15 million in there several years ago, which was somewhat of a surprise. It was a huge surprise, actually. Then $6.2 million was transferred by the legislature last session to help balance the budget. Thus, there was $10 million left in there. Realizing that the state was going to be facing another shortfall, we had no idea it was going to be the degree that it is. We thought that perhaps we could propose legislation that would take a small portion of this Cooper-Sams fund, use it towards emergency medical services specific programs that had some additional needs, with the assumption that the remaining amounts would be then used by the legislature to go towards balancing the budget. We met with management and budget and were told that the $10 million balance that we had was now $5 million. So from the end of May until three Fridays ago, the value of this fund has dropped by 50%. With that in mind, we thought perhaps we would cut back the amount of money we were requesting because it was $5 million, not $10 million, and hopefully transfer the dollars out into existing programs. The cover sheet you have with Bucks and my name on it gives a little bit of information on that. Since the legislature changed the nature of this program and things are more general fund oriented, $700,000 a year is put in the base budget, which goes into Cooper-Sams to help pay the credits for volunteer ambulance personnel. And
I could just stop you for one second, Mr. Doyle. Yep. Members, this is should be in your packets, I think. This is, no? Members have the document he's referring to. It says O.J. Doyle Jr. and Buck McAlpin.
Sorry, I apologize. I thought I'd been distributed.
Okay. I guess it's at the bottom of your packet, members. Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
But also in the statute was put an annual service credit of $447, which is the highest it's ever been. So after 5 years of minimum service, you go five times $447, and that's the amount of credits in your account, and you can keep going for as many years as you want. So the program is intact. $700,000 appropriated a year, $447 per year credit per volunteer. That's where the program is now. With the remaining $5 million, and it may be even a little bit less as I speak, I'm not sure exactly where the balance is going, we're proposing, and on this sheet, cover sheet you have, these numbers were based on $10 million, so if you look at the third page, you will see the cutbacks in the amounts that we're proposing for these programs. I can touch just briefly on the areas where we would like to see these dollars spent. The first one is the first responder reimbursement pilot project. First responders, rescue squads, or as they're called under the ambulance statutes, medical response units, are generally not reimbursed in Minnesota. Ambulance services are. A lot of times your local fire department will respond to an accident, help stabilize patients, extrication, things such as this, but they don't get reimbursed. The ambulance comes, we do. There are many circumstances where a first responder squad can get to the scene, and they tend to get to the first because there's more of them. They look, there's somebody who's sitting on the ground, and they go over and do an assessment, and they say, I don't need an ambulance. Just, you know, I lost my balance on fresh mown lawn. I spilled my groceries. I don't need an ambulance. I'm fine. And the first responder crew can do a quick assessment, cancel the ambulance. You pay the first responder squad or the medical response unit $100 for an assessment fee versus $800 for a paramedic staff advanced life support ambulance, you can save money to the healthcare system. And Buck and I are both paramedics. We've seen firsthand instances of this, but we don't have data. We do not have an empirical data where I can come in here and say, if you start paying first responders, we're going to save you X number of dollars. But we do know that, or we believe strongly that this is the case. To be able to gather the data, we thought if we can set up a pilot project, which would identify five first responder squads, medical response units, that are registered with the EMS regulatory board, meet state criteria, working with their local ambulance service, establishing a system of this kind of dual response cancellation when an ambulance is not needed, reimbursing the rescue squad a small amount, that we can help support the first responders who are part of the tiered response system and save the cost of an ambulance. If you're thinking, why would they ever want to reduce their reimbursements, it's real simple. Our volumes are going up. Our volume are going up like it is in hospital emergency rooms in many cases where they are not medically necessary calls. We cannot keep buying ambulances to respond. We need to figure out better ways of maximizing limited resources. And we think that this is a first step in the EMS delivery system to do that. And so we are asking for this appropriation transferred out of the Cooper Sams funds to help us set up this pilot project and to reimburse the five identified first responder squads that are involved in this. And the next one is regional EMS program. I'll let Buck talk about that one.
Mr. Doyle, I just let me
yes, ma'am, I'm sorry.
Second. We have quite a bit to get through today, and I'm with the pace with which we're going through this, I'm afraid we're not going to make it. We only have about five more minutes for the bill. So if you could kind of sum up for us, and remember, this is a policy committee, not a finance committee. So, and Representative Gottwald, I see you have your hand up. Can we wait till Mr. Doyle's done here, and we'll have a question. Thanks.
Let me just do it real quick. I'll just go ahead and finish up, Madam Chair, members. Buck McAlpin, President, Minnesota Ambulance Association. The last couple ones here are the appropriations to the Veterans Paramedic Program Apprenticeship. We started this with the Ambulance Association. Had an appropriation last year that was cut out the last day of the session. It asked for $200,000 transferred out of here. Basically, about 600-700 returning medics come back from foreign theaters, Iraq and Afghanistan. We want to capture those and place them in the workforce. The Department of Labor and an apprenticeship program that a trade association has to operate. The other one's Comprehensive Advanced Life Support, the CALS program. It's a homegrown Minnesota program developed by Dr. Daryl Carter out in Granite Falls. They do advanced training, paramedics, EMTs, nurses, physicians, about a team approach to how you work in emergency rooms. Obviously, in Hennepin County, you get a lot of that day-to-day, but you may not in Redwood Falls, and they go out around the state. With our new statewide trauma system that started 4 years ago, there's been a large demand on this group for training, and they've kind of been doing a lot of it voluntarily, and $100,000 goes towards that. The other piece is EMSC for children. We moved that down to $25,000. That kind of piggybacks onto some money with the CALS that helps with the pediatric part of that training. And the other piece of it is our 8 regional EMS programs. They coordinate all care throughout the state and work with our ambulance, first responders, and hospitals. They get about $150,000 a biennium from general fund. Their other major funding was seatbelt dollars. They get 90% of seatbelt fines. As people continue to wear their seatbelts, that money is pretty well dried up for them. We moved some money the last 2 years to help them and want to move $50,000 for the biennium for each region this time.
Okay, thank you. We can, let's see, we've got, I think we have yet another testifier, but let's go to questions right now, and if we can do those pretty quickly. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this is policy related. It goes to the dollars, but what else can the Cooper Sams money be used for? If it doesn't get drawn out to this, what else could that go for?
Mr. Doyle.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, I believe it will be used, as we've been told by numerous legislators, to help balance the budget. I mean, it's been made very clear to us that's the reason we came forward with the bill.
I think the key point is it's used for these pension service awards, but we're not jeopardizing that with these appropriations.
Right.
I don't know if that was part of it. And so the surplus, because it's growing, it's investment money partly, and that's one of the reasons it went from $10 million to $5 million, just like everything else. Mm-hmm. It lost its investment return.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Doyle. In terms of the responder pilot projects, and it sounds like it was aimed at looking at the trade-off in cost, whether there could be cost savings if you paid the first responders and then avoided the ambulance service. We have numerous situations in our state where we have our volunteer fire department, first responders going to major highways, being the first on the scene, but they do multiple things. They wouldn't necessarily avoid the ambulance coming. They do the initial treatment assessment, but then maybe it's still appropriate for the ambulance. But then they end up having to stay around, not only them, but a couple other fire trucks to provide kind of a safety barrier on the highway for the ambulance to do its work while it's there. And evidently there's now some best practices in place that basically indicate they have to do that, I've been told. Would your pilot projects, and I know a number of these departments are looking at being reimbursed for that kind of service as well, and they're concerned about that going forward with their small local fire departments, would your pilot projects be able to get at that issue, or have you thought of that?
Mr. Doyle?
Madam Chair, Representative, we've had discussions with the Fire Chiefs Association about this particular issue in the past, and we really haven't done much as far as moving forward with ideas. It is an issue. It is something we would like to work on in a cooperative fashion with them. There's not enough money, we believe, in this to really address that. And also, we have a very specific goal with this program, and we'd like to use this specifically to establish the empirical data on overutilization or inappropriate utilization of ambulance service.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Bunn.
Quick follow-up, and that's to the issue of beyond the pilot projects. If you've established that data that it does show there's that savings going on, where would that $100 reimbursement come from in the future when this is no longer there?
Doyle?
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, it would depend on what the results are of the pilot project. Right. We don't want to anticipate what the results are going to be. If it is there, then I think that you will be seeing some legislation in the future, cooperative between the fire chiefs and the ambulance industry.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bunn. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Mr. Doyle, I think I'm looking at the Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program and just wondering if you can share with me now or after the hearing what training the combat veterans need in order to meet the standard of civilian training.
Okay, Mr. Doyle, maybe if you can provide that after the hearing, that'd probably be...
I'd be more than happy to.
And this is going to go to Veterans Affairs.
Okay. All right, if there are no other questions right now, members, we have another testifier.
Thank you.
of Catherine Burke Moore. Welcome to the committee. If you would please identify yourself for the tape and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Burkmore. I'm the Executive Director of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, or EMS Regulatory Board. I'm here today to speak for the board. We have a 17-member board from a number of entities that provide EMS, from Fire Chiefs Association to paramedics, EMTs, the Department of Public Safety, Department of Health, etc. The board has taken the position to actually oppose this bill. And let me explain why. Because there are also many good things in this bill. So it's not opposing the programs within it. But the reason is the purpose of the Longevity Award, the Cooper Sams Longevity Award, is to retain qualified paramedic EMTs in the state of Minnesota. It's especially critical in the rural areas that often rely solely on volunteers for that response. And what we have seen over the years, and I have actually have a handout that kind of shows what goes on with the Cooper Sams. At age 50, with enough service credit, and the individual actually does have to retire, they can get a payout for being there, for staying on their services. What I'm handing out is kind of showing how this program has grown as far as people qualifying for it. And I think what's interesting in the last few years, we've also seen people retire, get their award, and come back in. I don't know if you've heard the firefighters pension talk about that people retire and don't come back. And this pension, you can come back in and re-qualify, but you would have to spend another 5 years on a service. And we're starting right now to start seeing people come back in. And that's the purpose of this program, to retain qualified EMS personnel. For the first time in 2008, we actually have accrued enough awards that we went above our now general fund appropriation of $700,000 in reimbursing them. So you'll see on this chart in the red $50,000 that we had to go into our investment fund. Now, our current investment is still $12 million because they have not taken a $6.2 million out of that fund to move to other uses. I think that the other fear of the EMS Regulatory Board is that this is seen as something that people can come into over and over and over again. And our fear is that at some point, if we don't have the funding to pay out the longevity award, people will leave right away.
Maybe I could stop you right there. We have a question from Representative Norton.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. It certainly could have waited, but I guess I'm wondering what the board's position would be about putting the entire Cooper Sams transfer fund into the general fund.
Putting it into the general fund. So if you took the $6.2 million that will be left after they take the $6.2 million to move that all into the general fund, what would happen is next year we would anticipate that there would be a number of folks that would qualify us for the award that would not get the award.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you. I don't want to be antagonistic, but the reason this bill was brought forward is because there seems to be a real concern based on history that the funds could be disappearing permanently. And rather than have it go into the general fund and disappear permanently, that there was a proactive effort, if you will, to keep it in the area. Certainly not exactly as you're suggesting it be spent, but to keep it in the area and be spent for EMS type services. And so I'm anticipating that your response would be that your board, while it's not supporting the proposal in front of you, also would not support moving it to the general fund.
Madam Chair, Representative, we would not support moving it to the general fund because then it would not be available for the longevity award. And right now, we've got people that are coming in that are above our appropriations. what we would like people to do is to understand the investment. Like I said to begin with, we don't have a problem with the program. We understand MAA's approach, which is different than the board. We feel very strongly that we must retain that investment money so that at any time, as soon as we start not being able to pay out everybody, the award is $447.19. It's set for each credit. So what we'd probably do is first come, first serve. If we didn't have the investment, there would have been 10 people that did not get an award out of the 148 that did. And so we're afraid if that gets out, why would people hang around to get the award? So our concern is keeping volunteers on to provide service.
Okay, we have, I'm going to let Representative Peason weigh in, then we have one more question, then we're going to try to move to a vote.
Well, okay. Another question.
Representative Gottwald? Okay. I wanted to go ahead, Representative Peason, and then I'm going to let the witness finish up real quickly,
let,
and then...
Let her finish up. Let's
okay. Mr. Burtmore, I'm sorry, we interrupted you. Did you have some closing comment you wanted to make?
I guess. One thing I like, I'm wondering if what I'm saying is making sense as far as our general fund award that we get is $700,000. Okay. We keep a small cut in order to administrate the program, and then we pay it out to the volunteers that qualify. We are now in the red when we try to qualify. That investment money, our concern is, again, that whole pot will be seen as something to take during this budget, and we want the legislature to realize that retaining volunteer EMS personnel statewide is critical to quality of life, especially in a rural area.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Burtmore. Representative Peason, do you want to have the final word
just
here?
Briefly, I think I don't disagree with what Ms. Burtmore just said about the importance of this fund. I think what's important to remember about this chart, though, is that we do have the $6 million currently in investment corpus, I guess, that so the you're still going to be able to pay out, I mean, even if this trend continues, you're still going to be able to pay out for several years into the future the full amount. You're just going to be buying into the corpus of that investment fund. In better times, we can perhaps revisit this, you know, that is something that we may need to address. I think what we're trying to accomplish with this bill is to say, even though that's the case, that money is out there, there may be a time to replenish in the future, and we're not going to have people without this Cooper Sam's money for several years from now just because we have the $6 million sitting there. There are other needs in the ambulance services that we should provide, which will also help rural ambulance providers just as much as the Cooper Sam's Award does, and we want to... that's kind of the goal of this bill. If it turns out that... And I don't think the governor actually touch this money in his budget proposal. So if that's the case, maybe this isn't the direction we should head. But I think that there's important needs we have both for the Cooper Sam's Award and to do these other things that also provide important support for rural ambulance providers and I would hope and urban ambulance providers to be and first responders to be quite honest. Metro is probably a better word than urban. That I would suggest that kind of as we think about allocating our resources from a policy perspective, this approach is not is a good one.
Okay, thank you, Representative Peason. If there are no further questions, Representative Peason renews his motion that House File 161 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Okay, the bill is passed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just have a question in between bills.
Okay, we're switching back here.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask the committee if to take note of something on some of the amendments, and then hopefully we can fix it going forward. I think as we are going to have a lot of work to do ahead of us, and sometimes the work gets very busy late in session, and I think it would be helpful to have timestamps on all the amendments so that we, as we look at them, we all know and we're all square on when things came in, when they didn't come in, and then we don't have to worry about confusion or our side of the aisle saying something happened that didn't happen or whatever. And so I just would make a request to the committee that we have timestamps on the amendment, and I think that will help us move along in a much better fashion, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. So this is what we're going to do with our 25 more minutes or half an hour remaining here. Mr. Chun is going to start out by giving us a little background on the non-emergency transportation service, just what the current program is, maybe 5 minutes. And then I think instead of presenting bills per se, I think I'd like people to spend maybe 5 minutes talking about what they think the real concerns are here. And what we really want to accomplish with this meeting is focusing on what's real and what's not real, because I think there's a lot of not real going on in this area. So, anyway, Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair and members, you should have a document titled Background Information, Special Transportation in your packet. You should also have something from the Department of Transportation titled Minnesota Commercial Truck and Passenger Regulations Fact Sheet. So I'll be referring to those documents. I've been asked to spend a little time providing some definitions of special transportation, then talk about level of need determinations, talk about regulatory oversight, and then the governor's proposals. Starting with definitions, special transportation services are defined in statute by reference to a definition in Minnesota rules. And this language in Minnesota rules says that special transportation means the transport of a resident who, because of a physical or mental impairment, is unable to use a common carrier and does not require ambulance service. And then the Minnesota rules also go on to define physical and mental impairment. The law on special transportation also states that special transportation includes driver-assisted service. This is in Subdivision 17, and this provision also appears in the language that's being amended in some of the bills. And it gives examples of what driver-assisted service is. Common carrier transportation, which is also referred to as access transportation services, is defined in rural as the transport of a recipient by bus, taxi cab, or other commercial carrier, or by private automobile. And I just want to mention briefly that one of the issues of contention in past years has been this idea of what is driver-assisted service and whether or not access transportation service providers are to be expected to provide some level of driver-assisted service, or whether by providing a driver-assisted service that automatically brings, you know, that into the level of special transportation. Talk now about level of need. Basically, all recipients who are seeking access to special transportation services need to be assessed through a level of need assessment. This is done by the Minnesota Non-Emergency Transportation, or MNET, program. And MNET has contracted with a company called Medical Transportation Management to provide these level of need assessments statewide to certify persons for special transportation services. The state law that governs the level of need assessment requires to be formed by a physician, a registered nurse, a physician's assistant, nurse practitioner, a licensed practical nurse, or a discharge planner. And it's performed no more than semi-annually unless circumstances have changed. It also exempts persons residing in a nursing home. Most of the level of need assessments are done over the phone. MTM staff speak with the recipients or a representative of the recipient. They may also call the recipient's health care provider. MTM can also do home assessments, although this is not a common thing that's done. Regarding regulatory oversight of transportation services, the Minnesota law requires special transportation providers to obtain written documentation from the health care provider that states the time the patient arrived. Patients are also to be transported to the nearest appropriate health care provider using the most direct route. Medical transportation records of service need to meet the standards that are in DHS rules. And something that was added in the past year is that it requires, or the record needs to contain a signed statement by the driver that indicates that the miles reported and the dates and times in the transportation record are accurate, and the driver understands that misreporting this information is fraud. In addition, Minnesota rules requires specified information that I have listed to be also documented. And also, special transportation providers need to comply with standards set by the Minnesota Department of Transportation. So this is that other handout that I referred to. And I won't go over what's on there, but it summarizes some of the requirements. And finally, I was asked to go over the governor's budget proposals. The governor proposes contracting with a vendor to manage fee-for-service special transportation services in the 11-county metro area. In its background, special transportation services in the metro area had been sort of managed by a vendor for the period October 1, 2006 through the end of January 2008, and then the 2007 legislature removed the authority to use the vendor for these services. MTM has managed access transportation services in the 11-county metro area since July of 2004. And then finally, the governor is proposing rate changes, proposing to increase the per-mile rate for special transportation services for persons who need a wheelchair van from $1.35 to $1.80, and then reduce the per-mile rate for services for persons who do not require a wheelchair van from $1.30 to $1, with these changes being effective July 1 of 2009.
And just, Mr. Chung, one just quick question I have. The level of need assessment is performed by a physician, etc., but then certified by MTM?
Or Mr. Chair, I guess MTM is the entity under contract to perform these level of need assessments statewide, and in doing so they would follow what's in state law.
So they have a physician on staff
or other, correct.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think you're taking a really good approach to this. If you have three bills, and they don't all quite agree, and there's even more coming, I think, on this topic. And I first got to work on this in 2003, and we thought we had it all resolved, and that wasn't true because it's been worked on in 2007 and beyond. And I think that it's good you're going to get out to some of the discussions. I'll give you just even an example about how this topic is so complex and the opinions vary. I started out carrying a bill for Mr. Widener, and at the end he doesn't like what I've done with it. So talking to my friend who's a careerist in the field, so good people, and these are both good people, disagree. So I thought I would turn over to my witness to...
Can you just move your bill first?
Oh, yeah.
Put an amendment on.
So you want to do the amendment? Okay. I'd like to move House File 200 to sit here for a while.
Okay. And
can I move the DE1 amendment?
Which, just again, the shape the author wants it, if that's all right with members. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That prevails.
And so we've shrunk down what we plan to do, and so if you want Mr. McCloskey to talk for a few minutes, and then Mr. Widener, would that be what you'd like?
That would be good, and we have a couple of other people from out of town that I'd like to get to. So really what we want to focus in on, what you really see are the key problems here, okay? This and not to kind of give a lot of background about your business and all that
okay.
kind of stuff.
The summary does provide the history of how the MNET program came into existence, what the issues were that existed in 2003 that resulted in the development of MNET.
And could you just say your name for the record? I'm sorry.
My name is Jay McCloskey. I was the registered lobbyist for the Special Transportation Service Association and worked with Representatives Abler and Powell in 2003 in what became the MNET program for legislation. One of the key issues that is addressed in the amendment that I think is very important is we have had a level of service operational since 2004 called access transportation. It is a taxi type level of service. You'll find in the other handout the comparison of prices between taxi cab rates in the metro area and other types of service. It also gives some historical rate information on what the rates were like back in 1979 when the special transportation program was first established. And access transportation has been a significant part of the non-emergency medical transportation component and services provided, and is nowhere described within the statute as one of those levels of service. I think it's important that we have a description in there of the level of service and officially authorize that within statute as a key component within what we do. It is the lowest cost of the provided services that exist for non-emergency medical transportation. And the other key thing I believe that we need to have is the clause that is in 17 the addendum broker dispatching prohibition. MNET was never intended, as it was originally designed, to have anything to do with special transportation services. Special transportation services were not a system. The delivery of the STS services was not broken. What was broken was the level of need determination and the ability to get people who did not need driver-assisted services to a doctor. That's what MNET was intended to fix. I believe we need a clear prohibition of STS from being dispatched and limit the role of MNET within the STS program exclusively to level of need determination. The other key thing that's
included... Can I ask a question on that?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. So you said initially it was for the level of need determination and the ATS brokering?
Yes. Okay. Basically.
And
for anyone who does not qualify for STS.
And you don't have a quibble with the ATS brokering as it currently stands right now?
Well, specifically, I do have a clause in here, subdivision 17B, which would specify, and I believe is important to include here, that payment for excess transportation provision of these services should be coordinated through the MNET program.
Okay.
And there is a key functional difference in ATS and STS that I believe eliminates the one and necessitates the other. STS, if you have a good level of need determination, that effectively becomes the gatekeeper for who needs STS. You have a physical or mental disability that results in your needing driver-assisted services, and that doesn't change a great deal. And there are provisions every 6 months, 2 years, whatever, they will reassess that. But if you need STS, you need STS. ATS is only one level of the services that a recipient may need to be able to get to the doctor. They may be able to drive their own automobile, if indeed they have gas, or it's insured, or it actually functions. If they don't have that, then they may be able to take a bus. If indeed they don't have pneumonia for the trip, and their medical service is a reasonable distance away from their home, that the bus is accessible. But if that's not an option, then they need some type of a taxi type of service to get to the doctor. And the importance in having these range of services available for people to be able to access their medical appointments is it saves money in people having timely access to medical care, preventing emergency services, hospitalizations, and I think it's very, very important for us to have clearly defined. But ATS is only the taxi level service. It's not all that MNET does. And they're not automatically eligible for ATS. They need ATS only if a private automobile or a bus or a volunteer are not accessible or appropriate for a given person for a given trip.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go back to the level of need determination. I just wanted to make a comment and maybe get an answer if I could. I have a problem with my counties, with my county and other counties who have a concern about a non-professional health person making the determination, such as a social worker. My social workers are, and I think most all social workers who work for our counties, are overworked and overburdened as it is.
Right.
So I'm just very concerned about a county social worker doing the assessment.
The social worker was added.
Mike Widener, I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association. The inclusion of the term county social worker came to us from social workers in Olmsted County, and I believe it's Fillmore County, and Nicollet, who have said that, you know, we can make this determination. We sit down with the individual, and we would like to have the opportunity to make this recommendation. We see them, we know what type of care they need. And so it was at that request that the county social worker piece was put in. Now, that is an optional piece. I understand Hennepin County does not want to do that. And this does not mandate any county social worker to do that, but what it does is it provides us the opportunity, if there's a county that wants to do that, that they can do that.
But it does, to me, I don't see it as an opportunity. I see it as an additional workload for the social workers in my county and other counties, the two counties that I represent, Rice and Steele, and throughout greater Minnesota. So you might have Olmsted in another county, but I think that we need to have other county social workers weigh on this determination factor before it goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think also to this question of whether social workers, I don't know whether they have the training, et cetera, to, and that's a question that we need to get answered, to actually do the assessment. But we, that's, I think, on our list here. So can we go briefly to just a couple of people that are from out of town and then come back, if that would be okay? And that would be who? Miss Roars, if that's, I'm pronouncing the name correctly, and Mr. Elwood. We're going a little bit out of order here, folks, but I think this will just kind of get some of the issues out on the table for us. And what I'm going to ask at the end of the hearing is that Representative Abler and Tao and Norton and anybody else who's interested get together and figure out what we do, and also save as much money as the governor saved to get there and come back with a proposal. Ms. Rohrer, is that how you say your name? I'm sorry. Okay.
My name is Dan Rohrer. I own People's Express. We're a rural special transportation company that I've been owned.
Can you move over a little bit to the... Yeah, thanks.
I own People's Express. It's a specialized transportation company that serves 40 rural counties along the western side of the state. Been in operating for 17 years. Providing special transportation, as you probably have been hearing, has endless challenges, and some of those are universal, and some of them are more critical to us rural providers, and it's the rural experience that I want to talk about. Special transportation is a very straightforward service. You pick up your passenger where they live, you take them to some kind of medical appointment, and this could be a regular appointment, it could be a treatment, it could be a hospital discharge. The reimbursement for special transportation is solely based on loaded mileage. So in other words, until you get your passenger in the van, there's no reimbursement to you. This becomes a real challenge in the rural areas. Often we need to drive 20 miles, sometimes more than 20 miles, before we even pick up our passenger. And all of that mileage is not reimbursed. It's simply impossible for anyone to have a driver in every town. And the towns are far apart. And so consequently, you have to drive to get somebody. It's just part of the equation. The other thing, along with the unreimbursed mileage, is while your driver is going to this pickup, he's on the clock too. So you've got a lot of payroll involved with this as well. In high population areas, your driver can probably do multiple trips in a day. For my driver, realistically, most of the time they're doing two. And part of that is because you bring them someplace, they have to wait there. They cannot go somewhere else. And then when they take their person home, then they can go do their next run. Just to give you an example of worst-case scenario, although it's not an unusual case, is if I get a call for me to pick up somebody at Parker's Prairie and bring them to the Alexandria Hospital emergency on a Saturday afternoon, my driver will drive 23 miles to get to the nursing home. We don't get any reimbursement there. He'll drive 23 miles to the hospital. Then he'll wait. And with an emergency run, they're really anxious for you to be there so that when this person's ready to go, they go home. Well, unfortunately, more often than not, 2.5-3 hours later, they've decided that they're going to keep this person and admit them. So now my driver drives back 46 miles. So in that scenario, we got paid $48.05 for that transport, and we drove 95 miles and had 4.5 hours of driver salary. Then comes Sunday, this person is now ready to go back home. The numbers aren't any better at all, except that we didn't have the 3 hours of waiting for them. Well, we probably had some time waiting when we got there. They weren't ready, but that's another story. So those are the kind of transports that we've started saying, we can't do these anymore. And I've been told by any number of people that if a transport loses you money, just don't do it. Well, that sounds easy. That isn't quite that simple. Unfortunately, I think us special transportation providers are kind of like closet social workers. We're really anxious to help the people and the facilities that we transport for, and saying no is really hard. Additionally, when you're talking about rural transportation, these are often people we know. They're the old school bus driver. They're the old librarian. They're our Sunday school teacher. They're the grandparents. They're the people that we know. And to say, I'm really sorry, but I can't take you because, you know, for me to drive 20 miles to drive you one just doesn't make sense.
So your issue really can be solved if we were to do something either to cover those deadhead miles or give people in the situation that have those long miles some kind of reimbursement increase to make up for that mm-hmm. difference. I mean, would that solve your problem?
There's always going to be rides that are bad. It's just that if you have some good ones to offset the bad ones, you can make that work. Unfortunately, there's not any good ones anymore. All of us providers have shifted costs. We've delayed getting new vehicles. The average mileage on one of my vans, I've got 44 vans, the average mileage is 300,000 miles on a van. And it doesn't take very long to put that on there because of the miles they drive.
And I think we're going to have to wrap up. I'm sorry, just so we can move on. So
the other thing I just did want to say was the RUCA system has been proposed as a way of addressing this. And it's a system that has been used for rural ambulances and will translate over into what we do. I just think as an industry we need to do something to keep these services alive. We've lost a number of them. And had gas stayed at $4, I don't know that there'd be any of us here speaking to you today. The other thing is I have 51 employees that depend on People's Express to continue to give them a paycheck. And so my drivers live in towns like Dundee and Monaga and Fulda, and these are towns that there are no other jobs for these people. And so I guess it's my job to try and keep the business operational, and so I'm asking you guys to come up with a formula to try and make that possible for me to do that.
Yeah, thank you. And that the RUCA formula, that's in one of the bills that I have, 374, which has a lot of other stuff in it, which is really not anything I'm particularly interested in. But 374 has the RUCA piece of it. So welcome to the committee. And there's like about 4 minutes here.
Okay, I'll make it quick. I'm Steve Elwood.
And thank you for coming up.
Thanks. You're welcome. I'm Steve Elwood from R&F Transport in Rochester. This is my 19th year up here at the legislature. It seems every year we have different issues. But I want to speak directly to the broker, and I just want to make 3 points. The first one is in that level of need situation that you guys brought up earlier. There's a financial incentive to downcone these clients from STS to ATS. You get $25 every time they go through a level of need. But if they can get these clients from going STS to ATS, then they can broker the drive. So as a result of that, we have all kinds of former clients who were once eligible for this service who have been denied. Some of these decisions are absolutely deplorable. I can give you countless examples, but here's one that I just heard about this morning. I was talking to our dispatchers and our reservationists. There's a gentleman named Fred Gack who lives in Goodhue, and he is bedridden. He was developing bed sores and needed non-emergency stretcher transportation to St. Mary's in Rochester. He was denied STS, and the situation only got worse. We were finally able to get his county caseworker involved, and after fighting for 2 days, he was able to get him stretcher certified for 1 day, but not certified for STS or further transportation in his electric wheelchair. As a provider, it's terrible declining service because the broker makes their determination, which appears to be lining their pockets. Number two, the broker claims to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is simply not true. If a client needs to be seen at an urgent care center, there is no way to certify them prior to rendering service. And they have not been easy to work with in certification retroactively. And finally, the introduction of this broker has pushed costs way up and has added a level of bureaucracy that was not in place before the DHS hired them. And by the way, the broker has been kicked out of many states for committing fraud, including their home state of Missouri. And I think some of you guys on this committee can remember what happened in 2007 when this broker was managing the STS portion in this 11-county metro area. It was a disaster. It got so bad that you had to put in provisions to get them to stop. And now the governor's bill is asking him to reintroduce that, and it's hard for us to understand.
Okay. Now, the economic incentive to down code would be solved if they actually brokered STS, right? Because then there wouldn't be an economic incentive for them, because they get paid either way.
That's right, but it would add a tremendous amount of cost to get them to broker every one of those rides.
So your position is we should get rid of the broker for everything?
That'd be my position.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. I think we're not going to have time to get through. I do think we should actually give the broker a chance to respond to some of this stuff. We're going to come back and get to your stuff. It's just not going to happen today, unfortunately. But you're here more often. That's why I went with everybody else. I apologize. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Elena Macia. I'm the CEO of MTM, and I'm here to kind of just discuss the services that MTM, through what we call in the 11-county area,
Midland. And we have like 4 minutes as well.
Right, so I wanted to ask you, did you want me to provide a summary or address some of the specific issues that have been
raised? I think if you could, I think we're going to have another discussion. Why don't we just address what this guy said?
Okay.
What Mr. Elwood said.
And Mr. Elwood's from the outstate area, right?
I understand that, yeah.
So we don't broker ATS in the outstate area. So simply moving somebody from SGS to ATS in the outstate area generates no additional revenue for MTM, first of all. Second of all, in the 11-county area, if you're on SGS, and SGS is really reserved for those people who need assistance from probably their bed or inside their home to get into the vehicle. It's not a generalized service for the generally healthy population or whatnot. It's special services. It's also for somebody who, once they get to maybe a large medical center, can't get to the 8th floor, suite 8011. It's to help assist them because they have dementia or Alzheimer's and won't get to the 8th floor suite if they aren't provided services. In the 11th county, if we move somebody from SGS to ATS, once a medical practitioner's level need assessment has been reviewed by a nurse in our office, we don't get lots of additional revenue because you're usually moving somebody from wheelchair SGS services or ambulatory SGS services down to sedan level services or wheelchair level services, which range in cost from $18 to $25 a trip. We are reimbursed $21 a trip. So it's not a windfall. In fact, we lose a lot of money on those trips. We're simply adhering to DHS's requirements on reviewing the individual's level of need and assigning the most appropriate and cost-effective mode of transport, which is the requirement under the state law. But I have lots of other information. You know, MNET is a local-based program. It provides 50 local jobs. It's staffed 24/7 with bilingual individuals so that when you're a immigrant into the local metro area and you have to get your children immunized so they can go to school, you don't know how to circumvent the system. So you have a toll-free number no matter what county you're in, 11 counties, one phone number to call and to talk to somebody in your native language. If we can't provide one of the bilingual staff, we have AT&T language line services so that they can get to their medical service either through bus, gas reimbursement, sedan, or wheelchair-less vehicle. So we're providing a valuable service to the constituents and to the Medicaid recipients so that they can access their preventative health care services to lower the case of aggravated cases of health care issues that result in hospital stays, emergency room visits, ambulance calls, whatnot. And I think there's been a lot of misinformation on the actual cost of the program, too. I don't know if you'll need to address that.
Well, we're gonna have to come back and talk about that. And
mm-hmm.
So thank you for coming today. So we're going to have to adjourn at this point.
Sure.
And we'll spend some more time on this numbers in the next week or so. We'll try to find some more time to do that.
Thank you
for coming. And I understand there's a Mr. Xiong, Waseng Xiong in the audience. Are you local? Are you nearby?
Yes, I'm local.
Could you come back at another time? Would that put you out too much? Okay, I apologize. Thank you for coming today. We're adjourned members. Oh, we're going to lay over Hospital 200. All right, and then we're adjourned.